Our historian, Dr. Grant Morris, this week has been thinking about the history of the relationship between New Zealand and Japan. He's currently in Tokyo and he joins us on the phone. Hello there.
Hi, Jesse.
Doing anything exciting?
Yeah, actually over here with the international negotiation, the competition, so with the New Zealand representative team, which is from Victoria University, so we're going to be competing against a number of different countries, and it's hosted here in Tokyo. So
that's a law thing, hey?
Yes, so legal negotiation.
So when you and me were at law school, when you and I were at law school, it was the mooting competition, but is this the sort of like the face of the new law school energy?
Yeah, so mooting is still very popular, but you know, you remember back when we were at law school, alternative dispute resolution was really the buzzword, and that's really come into its own. And this is a good example of one of the ADR competitions, which is held around the world.
You've been to Japan before?
Yes, I have actually. Yes, my brother taught English here for a few years, and I stayed with him in Tokyo for a little while. So it's been a while. It's been 18 years, so it's good to be back.
And it's got you thinking about our relationship with Japan. So what sort of set you on this course?
Yeah, so I wanted to think and structure it in a way where we could look at the Japanese influence in New Zealand and also New Zealanders in Japan. And there's probably more to say about the Japanese influence in New Zealand, so perhaps if we start there. And I divide it into three main phases, and if we look at New Zealand from colonisation onwards. And with Japan, for about 250 years, from the early 1600s through to 1868, the country was effectively shut off from foreign contact, that people weren't allowed to leave or come in, basically, under the Tokugawa shogunate. And that meant that there was no contact between Japan and New Zealand. So we would get, for example, Chinese in New Zealand in the gold mining and the gold rush, and we get people from India as well early on. We don't have that early Japanese influence until Emperor Meiji begins to open up Japan in 1868, and that's when we start to get the first Japanese coming to New Zealand, whether the sailors on naval vessels or few settlers, members of circuses even, or martial arts troops. So we get a few, but the numbers are very small.
And New Zealand wasn't particularly welcoming for a while there too.
No, and we've heard a lot about that, of course, in relation to Chinese New Zealanders and the racism of the time and the fact that they were denied many basic civil and human rights. And what we have with Japan under the Immigration Restriction Act 1899 is basically very difficult for Asian people to immigrate to New Zealand because New Zealand's running a white New Zealand policy, basically encouraging immigration from the European countries. And up until World War II, there were virtually no Japanese New Zealand citizens, very, very few. So while in places like Wellington and Auckland, other places, you can see pockets of Chinese and Indian immigrants going way back, we don't necessarily have that comparison with Japan. And I think that's partly to do with the history we're talking through, but partly Japan as well, in the way that it was closed for so long. And when it did open up, it moved quickly, but there wasn't that kind of a diaspora, if you like, in the same way as you get with other countries. But when, of course, that changes dramatically.
Yeah, when did it begin to change?
Yeah, so that changes dramatically after World War II, and many of your listeners will know the story and perhaps even be involved in it. So, you know, that we'll talk later about that catastrophic event of World War II for Japan. But once Japan creates itself as an economic powerhouse rather than a military powerhouse, then it sends its goods out into the world, its cars, its tourists, its technology. And, of course, that has a big influence on New Zealand. So the whole, you know, ubiquitous made in Japan, I think, you know, when we were young, was probably more of a common cliche perhaps than made in China or other ones are today. And that was because of that huge amount of production that was coming out of Japan and leading to a massive increase in standards of living. And once we get to an opening up of New Zealand's immigration policy in the 1980s, we get, of course, big increases in Asian immigration. And while for Japanese, it's still relatively small compared to, say, Chinese immigration and Indian immigration. By 2006, we were 12,000 Japanese in New Zealand, and so that's a huge increase on what was there only 10 or 15 years ago. And, of course, we also get the young Japanese coming to learn in our schools and universities.
I'm speaking with historian Dr. Grant Morris about the relationship between New Zealand and Japan. An update on Link 3, no winner yet. So my next clue for you is to look at the albums that our three Link 3 songs came from. Most recently, we played Gene Genie by David Bowie. And before that, It's All Coming Back to Me Now by Meatloaf. And before that, a particular version of Sweet Caroline by Neil Diamond. Good luck, everyone. And 2101 to text. So that's the Japanese in New Zealand, Grant. What about New Zealanders in Japan?
So, of course, again, we get that period where Japan's effectively shut off for 250 years. But once it opens up, very few New Zealanders, really, before World War II. And you'd have to ask, you know, what would they be in Japan for? There may be some in terms of military connections. Trade, but they're relatively, those connections are very weak at that time. So only after, again, World War II, and partly in, it's in the photo on the webpage, J-Force, which is that group of New Zealand soldiers who play a part in the Japanese occupation after World War II. So they're there, 12,000 of them. But later on, we get New Zealanders there on trade and of course, growing tourism. And then from the 1990s, on teaching English as well in places like Tokyo and Osaka. I always remember my grandmother visited Japan in the early 60s, one of the few New Zealanders probably doing at that time. It was a formative experience to her. She just couldn't imagine a more alien place in terms of different to New Zealand. And I'm sure that it would have been vice versa for Japanese coming to New Zealand and seeing New Zealand as an alien place in the 1960s. And the difference today is huge. So even though there's not a huge amount of New Zealanders in Japan, there's more than say, before World War II.
Yeah, that's the elephant in the room, isn't it, when it comes to the New Zealand-Japanese relationship, World War II?
Yeah, and for a generation, you know, that was just such a key moment, and it coloured everything. So just going back to my example of my grandmother, her brother was killed during World War II, for that generation to be at war with Japan as part of the Pacific War, you know, fighting in battles like Guadalcanal against Japanese, and that fear of invasion, you know, the idea that there were submarines in New Zealand harbours, and you know, Darwin was being bombed. That was very real. I mean, for our generation and younger generations, we didn't grow up with that, but for generations before that, that was very real. And it's taken time, I think, for that to change. But obviously, that was a huge connection between New Zealand and Japan. And what many people also remember is the tragedy at Featherstone, where there was a prisoner of war camp for captured Japanese soldiers and prisoners. Mm. And there was a sit-down strike, and possibly a charge was very confused what actually happened. But as a result, 48 Japanese prisoners of war were shot dead by the New Zealand guards. And basically, it was kept secret during the war to avoid any reprisals against New Zealand prisoners of war in the Pacific. And a military court of inquiry cleared the guards. But that was when it came out afterwards. And that's one of the greatest tragedies that we have in terms of loss of life. And treated differently in a way because it happens in the context of war than, say, a peacetime disaster. But in terms of numbers and just the sheer tragedy of it, something that we think back to as well.
And then the New Zealand and the Japanese occupation forces too.
Yeah, so this is J-Force. This is actually really interesting, and I love that photo that's on your webpage there, because it has a New Zealand soldier with some Japanese children, and they again, just going back to this such different cultures, such a culture shock from both ends. And the New Zealand soldiers are, you know, sharing a joke. And a lot of New Zealand soldiers came with J-Force after the Second World War with quite anti-Japanese attitudes stemming from the war and what had happened, but left with a greater appreciation of the culture. People like Peter Mann, for example, the famous judge from Erebus, he was part of J-Force. And a generation of New Zealand men had the opportunity, or some of them had the opportunity, to see this culture and actually left with a greater appreciation. So they went in with one view and came out with another. And I think that's really, in many ways, the story of our talk today, is that the increasing connection between the countries through trade and diplomacy and peacekeeping has actually helped to increase that understanding, with that understanding, you know, better relations overall. Because, you know, as The Last Samurai suggests, which was filmed, of course, with Mount Taranaki being Mount Fuji, you know, there's a lot of similarities between the two countries.
Grant Morris in Japan. Enjoy your time there.
Cool. Thanks, Jesse.
Nice to chat.